The Athletic.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
He's round the goalkeeper, he's done it! Absolutely incredible!
He launched himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter who was without a shadow of a doubt giving him lip.
Does it tame and tame and tame again?
Crank up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
What's it like to do your job in front of 40,000 people? What's happened to the diving header? What's the most common spark for an argument between teammates on the pitch? What's the saddest ever example of goal music? What phrases should be banned from football commentary? And what's it like to plant your studs into the ankle of Robert Pires? Brought to your ears by The Athletic, this is Football Clichés. Hello everyone and welcome to episode 105 of the Football Clichés podcast. I'm Adam Hurry and alongside me is David Walker. Dave, I've done it again. I've got a co-host with the same first name as our guest. What if you cancel each other out?
Well, I'm sure we won't do, but you're going to have to come up with like a football-y type nickname for one of us, aren't you, I suppose?
Suspect I might just. Yes, with us for Mesut Haaland Dicks this week is ex-Premier League ace turned Sky Sports presenter, David Prutton. Hello, David.
Hello. I mean, part of that introduction is correct. The other part is a completely misleading. So take out that what you will.
No, not at all. We all know that ace is a very flexible term in football.
It's like legend getting tossed around carelessly. I should have told you that. That's another one that gets on my nerves. Go on.
Definitely. I mean, no. Legend. Legend could be is perfectly up for debate.
Yes.
Ace simply means you existed and you kicked a ball once. So that's fine.
Really subjective.
So let's address this burning issue of what we call each other. Dave is Dave. I mean, I could call you David. I could call you Prutz, but that's a slippery slope. If I start calling you Prutz, I feel like I'd end up burning your clothes in the dressing room or something.
Well, yeah, and doing other. I mean, that was out of the things that I've seen with my own eyes with regards to what has gone on in the dressing room. I'd take that over some of the other stuff. And anybody, I think, if you go too early, throwing your own nickname around can make you sound like a bit of a whopper. But I would universally be known as Prutz in whatever tiny universe people remotely give a monkeys about what my nickname is. So if that makes it easier for you, Adam, I'm happy to answer to that.
The Football Clichés universe is perfectly happy with Prutz. Prutz it is. Do you know, I'm very grateful for you sparing your time for us. Because, you know, in my head, you're preparing for a record 108th cap for England under-21s.
Do you know the real benefit of being able to hoover up a lot of caps is getting on with the manager at the time, who was also your former club manager, David Platt, which was... it was Howard Wilkinson to start with, and then David took over. And then, like you said, I got too old and my international career fell off a cliff.
Oh, what a wonderful way of putting it. Well, I'm glad you're taking it in fantastic humour. Do you know what? Our Football Clichés intermittent fixer, the kind of Pini Zahavi of the football podcast world, Phil Hay, he billed you as a, and I quote, clever mentalist. So I have high hopes for this episode.
Wow. I mean, that's as oxymoronic as you could possibly wish for as a description, isn't it? So I'll take that. We'll soon see. In 5 minutes, you might pretend that the feed's dropped and you both buggered off. Haven't you? So that...
We haven't got anybody else. Exactly. So stick with
just
it.
Talk amongst yourselves, chaps, for the next hour.
Yeah. Dave, now I was going to say to our guest, be gentle with us, but neither of us are Premier League linesmen circa 2005. So I imagine we're probably safe, aren't we?
Yes, I have watched the YouTube video in preparation for this recording.
Good.
I mean, is it, just give us it from purely your standpoint, chaps. I mean, in obviously at the time, it's the most heinous crime anyone's ever committed on a football field.
Sure.
With the benefit of hindsight, it's comical to say the least. I mean, the size of the kit I'm wearing, the hairstyle that it's not too far from what I've got now. The hairstyle that I deemed to be pretty decent back in the mid-noughties, and just the general kind of bizarreness to it all. From your points of view, how do you view it? Is it something that you would allow your kids to see? Would it affect the next generation? Or
I'm not going to get too moral about it. Absolutely not. I veer towards the Barry Davis end of the spectrum of not wanting to see this sort of thing. But I mean, my first thought about that incident when you kicked off against Arsenal in 2005 was that I don't really know what you were complaining about. I mean, you absolutely took Pires apart with a studs up tackle.
Yeah.
Into his ankle. I mean, it's the most straight red I've ever seen, but yet it was still only a second yellow.
Still only a second yellow. And the first yellow was very close to a red anyway, to be fair. And I think that in my hissy fit, which is a very vanilla way of putting it, I saw a grave injustice taking place before my very eyes, of course. And there was a picture on the Monday morning, I think, in one of the papers, which showed the actual challenge, which had, I mean, my face contorted in utter rage and absolute frustration, and a very straight leg with a very straight set of studs on Robert Pires's ankle, which as he got stretched off and I was muttering in his general direction about his the backbone of a player of a great player such as that, who was also very, very tough, questioning his ability to stand a football pitch in that moment, seeing it back so many times, you're kind of going, yeah, he did well to actually play again after that, I think. So
Dave, one of my other favourite bits about the episode is the linesman, the targeted linesman, just sort of looking away as if he doesn't look at David Brutton, then he can't hurt him.
Yes, Paul Norman, to give him his name.
Oh, that was his name?
Yeah, yeah. So I've just read...
It's such a linesman name.
I'm reading the report from The Guardian from the time.
Who wrote it?
He said, Matt Scott wrote this report in March 2005. Brutton admitted two counts of improper conduct for laying hands on Wiley in an attempt to reach the assistant referee, Paul Norman.
Wowzers. Laying hands on Wiley. I mean, that's almost a euphemism, isn't it? You could use that for a myriad of different things. I mean, and subsequently, I know Alan really well. I actually worked with the PGMOL in the summer, which thankfully it's gone full circle, hasn't it, with regards to me chairing things where we're all discussing stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, it jogged my memory, actually. I was reading something this week that Henry Winter had written off the back of the Newcastle Spurs game and passing judgment on Jonjo Shelvey coming on and getting subsequently sent off. And just use one word after the sentence describing it of idiot, which I'm sure it brought back not very deep-seated memories of it, but I think there was a lot of that with regards to the kind of summation of what I'd done. I mean, lots of idiots and lots of fingers being pointed at someone who looked mental.
Well, I mean, I think you've made your peace with it now. We're not here to...
I have done, so you brought it up, for Christ's sake. I was totally over it, but now, 16 years later.
I'm glad you mentioned that Jonjo Shelvey report, because when I typed into YouTube earlier on to attempt to find the footage, which is actually quite difficult, the first result that comes up on YouTube if you type in David Brutton red card Arsenal is a video simply titled Idiot Brutton.
Which absolutely the two words just dovetail. I think that's brilliant. I mean, it's so succinct that you couldn't possibly wish for anything else.
Oh, I might call you Idiot Brutton from now on.
There can be the nickname, Adam. There you go. That'll do.
This is too much fun. We're having too much fun. We've got a Mesut Haaland Dix to do here. Right, let's get started. You bombarded me with your footballing loves, quite frankly, via WhatsApp. So I had to whittle it down to three and maybe four if you're lucky. Tell us about your first one. First one is it's very sentimental.
It's being in a place where the same sentiment is getting shared by a hell of a lot of people at exactly the same time, be it a goal, be it the near miss, be it somebody going mental at a referee. Everyone has got the same variation, that particular emotion. The big crowds and the big noise, the sights, the sounds, the smells. Having listened to a lot of these podcast chaps, there's not many people that would veer away from what that is, because it is such a very, very primal thing. And kind of connected into that, and having had the pleasure of, I say, playing at Anfield, being there in body, but not necessarily doing anything to affect what was going on with either 21 lads on the pitch, just trying not to be crap for the best part of an hour and a half in front of a lot of people, and then going back and working there and being able to hear the cops sing "You'll Never Walk Alone" and what it means to not just people in Liverpool, but what it means to the wider footballing world is one of if not one of the most moving sporting things you could possibly be part of. It's just a glorious communion of people who want exactly the same thing at that exact time.
So I mean, we're constantly reminded of the Anfield atmosphere from a playing perspective. Is it a particularly unique atmosphere to play in?
It's just, I mean, because of how football stadium has changed somewhat, it's obviously still got that real tradition to it. It's quite pokey down. Well, it was obviously quite pokey. Now it's, I mean, you can drive a bus right up to bloody the touchline almost. What it was quite pokey, a lot of little back rooms, and then you go down the steps and the Anfield side, and then you come back up and then you're into...
Are away players allowed to touch it?
No. I mean,
is that done thing?
No,
that'd be weird.
It is there and you see it and the opposite...
It's not yours.
No, and you don't want to get on anyone's nerve. You don't want to poke too many birds at Anfield. It's hard enough as it is trying to get in and not get spanked, really. But having been in and then being able to you kind of walk up and there's not many stadiums where you walk up and then you're actually in the middle of the actual stadium, because obviously you used to go down and come back up and bang, you were there. So it was a truly unique atmosphere. And it's one of those where I don't want to kind of sound too twee about it, but it's almost that kind of Forrest Gump moment where you find yourself stood in like the background of something or a scene, and there is that kind of where you're scratching your head going, what, why, how have I got here, and what am I...
Feel free to do a Forrest Gump impression like Neil Warnock if you like.
That was brilliant. And then I think Simon Jordan jumped on top of it as well to describe... This shows how much I'm listening to sports football media. He'd done it on his show with Jim White using the box of chocolates analogy with Spurs, I think it was. But yeah, it is one of those where... And then after that, with regards to performing at a place like that for a player that would be in kind of my skill set, it's just about two sets of 45/48 minutes of total and utter concentration and not hopefully putting a toe wrong, let alone a foot.
So before a game, if you've gone out, you're on the pitch, you're lining up at Anfield, you'll never walk alone, is being belted out on the cop. Are you focusing completely on the match there, or are you sort of taking it in?
You're trying to, but what they managed to do, and the great thing about it is, and I'm not saying, the reason that they probably do it for that is because it builds that crescendo just before kickoff. So there's not much of it when you're warming up, but as you are coming back out again and as the players are on the pitch, it's done to absolutely maximise what that place is and what that place means to the people and the players on the pitch. But also, the other side of that is, obviously, you get the opposition fans and the opposition players seeing it at exactly the same time and going, wow, that's crazy what they're doing there. And I think that's when you become aware of it. And then after that, without getting too boring about the kind of fundamentals of what it would be to be a professional, or what it is to be a professional sportsman, that's when the professional side of it has got to kick in, because you've got to focus. You can't, your mind can't go wandering anywhere. You've got to make sure that you are totally zoning, because with the team that I went there with Southampton, it was greater than obviously the sum of its parts. So you had to make sure that what you were told to do for that specific period of time, you did.
Well, I mean, that's enough sentiment for me, because I'm rather more interested in some minor technical points about what it's like to play in front of a crowd. Because football fans, I think, take it for granted the idea that you've got to perform in front of them. And I'm especially interested by a very specific scenario. So you're away from home, you're 2-0 down, and the entire home crowd are basically gleefully ridiculing every attempt your team makes to drag themselves back into the game. Now, from my perspective, that looks like the most psychologically challenging thing in football, is trying to overcome the fact that everyone, 40,000 people, are just going, your shit, at everything you try and do because their team are in a comfortable position. Is that the most mentally challenging environment to play in?
I would, yeah, I'd say so. I mean, it's possibly worse when it's your own team giving you a load of shit when you're not doing... sorry, your own fans when you're not doing too well. I'd say the thing that... So obviously working on games where there was no crowds and you had the augmented sound and all that type of rubbish, you only got positive cheers and oohs and ahs, didn't you? And the first time we got back and you had a crowd and you were... You thought, I've actually missed that. That's
life.
That's the sarcastic side of what it is to be a footballer. And there is an element of that. I quite... In reveled, I mean, I once you've probably seen from that clip on YouTube, I would be a little bit combative, but you can't take away from what that specifically is, because it's part of the match day experience. You have to go there, you have to perform, you have to deal with everything that's thrown at you, whether it's ball boys that are a bit turgid about coming and helping out you, particularly trying to get the ball back in play, or whether it's to do with you being able to battle up against the team, the players, everything that's up against you. And the great thing is, when you beat that, it's fantastic. When you lose, it's just so frustrating. It's frightening.
We'll get on to mischievous ball boys very shortly, actually. My final question about what it's like to play in front of a crowd. This is an oft-repeated cliche, but I've never heard anybody involved in football actually confirm it. Does the anxiety of a crowd actually transmit itself to the players?
No, the frustration does. The frustration, right. Absolutely. Well, you know, that collective, there's nothing more soul-destroying than a when it's you that's particularly misplaced the pass. When, yeah, and you want to kind of make the point in that instant to everybody that's watching it, I didn't mean to do that, everybody. Sorry, it's not gone to its intended target. I'm not doing it to piss you off or the manager or the players. I'm doing it because I've got the best intentions. It doesn't transform, but there are some times when you do get that little inkling, when you do feel what the crowd are feeling. But again, you've got to absolutely try and, well, attempt to block that out and get on with not being average.
Sometimes I think, just to like try and relate this perhaps to our audience who obviously play amateur football or whatever, in the same way that they say it's easier to give a speech in front of a room of 5,000 people than a room of 15. Mm. I find sometimes if you're ever in a situation where you're playing like five a side, like I was last night, and there happens to be like three little kids outside the pitch.
Why do people watch five a side? Go away.
They're just knocking about, and they were just giving, there must have been about seven or eight, and they were just absolutely ripping it out of all of us every time we misplaced the pass.
I know
just
that pitch.
So awful. Humiliating.
Why do they do it?
I think that Dave, that's such a good point, because then it becomes specific. Then it becomes like that playground element of we're all looking at you specifically, and this group of five or six people are laughing at you and sharing in whatever misfortune that you're experiencing. Then with, like you say, with a sea of people, it's a bit, I mean, it's always great when you pick one out who is gesticulating, you know, direction. You think, oh shit, I've made eye contact with him now. I'm, oh God, how can I?
Never directly engage one-on-one. How can I? Like, that's
what you've got to learn. It's like walking through crowds, like fix that point on the horizon, which is always that set distance away that you're never going to get to it. Hence, I'm explaining to you what the horizon is there. Sorry, fellas.
Yeah, that's good.
Is this a new thing, the horizon? It'll never catch on. I thought you were going to sail over the edge. Because I remember having a privilege of playing in front of big crowds and not so big crowds. And we had Alan Neil at Scunthorpe, of all places. And obviously, Neil's gone on to do wonderful, wonderful things alongside Chris Wilder. But Alan Neil, 6.5 foot tall, stood by the dugout, the local scunny, the fellow with all the quips, just Alan. Yeah, and like you think, I can hear him getting battered by someone behind the dugout. Because all of us are crap, and you're kind of thinking that can't be what it got into management for at all. And then obviously, when you see him further on down the line and he's high-fiving Jose with Chris Wilder, you think, yeah, you deserve that. After putting in the hard yards at Glanford Park, you deserve the glamour that comes with that.
Yeah, he still looks like an assistant undertaker, but still, fine. I mean, fair play to him.
Assistant to the assistant undertaker.
Yeah, exactly. Right, okay, so we've set the scene. We've got the atmosphere. We have. We've got the crowd going. Tell us about your second love of football.
The second one is, for some reason, as soon as I say this, it's Andy Gray that pops up in my head. It's diving headers, which there is a lot of debate and conjecture. I mean, of the broader aspects of heading footballs is one that's very much up for public debate, and quite rightly so. Mm. But to see one in all of its glory, the thumping header where the centre forward, I'd say winger, but wingers are tough enough to do it, would throw himself in front of a ball that possibly nowadays is gone for with the foot, or more often than not, the wrong foot. And you think, why has he got nowhere near that? Just throw yourself at it. And my son is 9 years old, and he's learning, not learning his trade, like I'm trying to flog him to death.
Get
him into an academy sooner rather than later, son. They're on 10 grand a week by the time they're 11. Yeah, it's wonderful. And he was chatting. He was asking, I don't know why he was asking me, Christ, about can we practice diving headers? And I was... It was that. So we'd done a couple with a very soft football. Let me reiterate that. Mm. And I was trying to get the trajectory right so he could kind of do it. And there's that timid kind of little jump at it and then a couple of steps and not obviously take. And the minute he took off, I mean, knocked the wind out when he landed on his stomach. But the sense of kind of like glee, like almost like it unlocked a door, like, oh my word, like the power on it, the direction on it, the commitment. I mean, you never said that, but I'm putting words in his mouth.
Showing a 9-year-old diving headers, it's like, I'm not showing him black and white TV. This is
exactly
incredible.
Like this archaic way of launching this pumped up round thing towards the net. It was just wonderful. And it almost like it unlocked something in his mind. And I just don't think, without sounding like an old ex-pro and someone that watches a lot of football, they're not prevalent enough anymore, are they? It's I presume you two may have discussed this at some stage, professionally or privately. But
my question is, were they ever prevalent, really?
Or maybe, maybe
that's a very good point. This golden age of diving headers.
The golden age. But maybe right there, maybe the fact that somebody like Andy Gray stands out for doing diving headers was because he was the only person that did diving headers back in the day.
So it was about half a foot off the floor.
Maybe there is a bit of that. Maybe they've done away with the horizontal. It's all about the vertical now. It's Ronaldo 7 foot in the air, like poised, ready to pounce.
The only theory we've ever posed on this podcast about this when we've discussed it is that a ball arriving at diving header height is basically never going to be intentional. It's not something you'd ever plan.
No, it's an underhit cross.
So it's either going to aim, you're going to stick it on somebody's head where intended, or you're putting it, you know, it's a cut across the floor. So crosses have just got better. Is that the only way we can think
that's
of it?
Such a
pitches and crosses are
a
better,
wonderfully positive way to put it. Yeah, the progression in crossing caused the extinction of the diving header. I think that's, yeah, I could see that.
To pick up on a point you just made about teaching your son how to perform diving headers. Dave, I mean, I've never thought about diving headers as something anybody would practice. I thought it was just something, you know, you just pluck out of your kind of muscle memory, out of nowhere in a time of need.
Yeah, it feels to me like a completely improvisational skill. Yeah, definitely. As you just said about the crossing, it's a reaction to a cross that's under hit or over hit or it's bounced, defenders missed it and it's bounced and you just got to get something on it. Like, I mean, but also it'd be, you know, be like,
you're not going to do a diving header
turn
drill,
up on,
you,
right, lads, today's session, diving headers. Yes!
Exactly. do you know, the funny thing is, you've said that, Dave, and that's just completely jogged my memory. We used to, when I was at Nottingham Forest, when Paul Hart was in charge, so Paul had us in the youth team, and we used to play these 2v2s in what would have been a 10 by 10 square. It's probably called, I mean, Marcelo Bielsa probably calls it murder ball now, but we were doing it Christ 20, however many years.
Oh, I see, right.
You know what I mean? These things are cyclical, chaps. Don't worry about that. Boss 9, we did it. 20, no, we didn't. We didn't have a very good number 9. So, and there was an element of doing that where you had 2v2, two little girls, and you just, and it was as much about character building as it was about skill, because we just leathered each other to death. But part of that was a slalom drill where you had to run to a like touch a cone on the diagonal, get down, and then throw yourself through a muddy patch doing a diving header into a goal. So we bizarrely practiced that, but it's something along the lines, like you're saying, Dave, of it's like saying, right, lads, today it's your overhead kick finishing session. What? When's that ever going to happen? And then suddenly it's about being able to improvise, as you say, doing the right thing for a crap ball. I mean, Trevor Sinclair, let's be honest. He actually mentioned the fact that he practiced it in training, which I think it was Max Rushton talking to him, who was incredulous. He said, come on, you weren't practicing doing that in training, waiting for the ball at the perfect height. Well, yeah, of course we are. And you're kind of thinking, really, were you? But yeah, it's completely improvisation.
Practice something that relies on somebody else doing something perfectly in the first place.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. If you could under-hit this cross at all times, I might be able to have a diving header on it.
Diving headers got me thinking that if you take a step back from it, I mean, from football generally, and you look at it and think, who the hell invented this? Because it's a bit of a weird thing to do with your body, kicking a ball. I mean, and propelling a ball with your body is basically quite an absurd thing. But I think diving headers are the most logical extension of that. It's such a weird thing for someone to decide that they're going to do. So we asked our listeners, what is the weirdest standard way a footballer propels a ball? Sam warms us up with throw-ins. The only thing more weird than throwing a ball like that are all the silly rules you have to follow while doing it. I know you've got a bit of a bee in your bonnet about throw-ins, but that didn't quite make the final list.
It's just completely vanished. How many times do you watch a game now where you're thinking, that's definitely a foul throw? But unless it's literally the one where he's got the hands in front and just drops it on the floor, the referee will then blow. The amount of times covering football, as I'm privileged to do, across different countries, it's the death of the throwing, lads, is a very, very real thing.
Andrew Lorne takes this up another level. He says, the weirdest ball propulsion method for me is the pec/shoulder flick, primarily because it looks odd, but also because it generates almost no power, and I don't think anyone is really sure whether it's handball or not. I mean, this reminds me, Prats, that I mean, I'm against chesting generally, unless it's cushioning the ball. I don't like chesting being used as a pass. I think it's very pretentious and a bit too showy.
I think there's no power. It's got to be there purely as a means of control for you, purely for yourself to do something else with your knee, your foot, whatever. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, having never had a chest capable of that, nor playing with any players that did have a chest capable of that, it would have been. I think the great thing would have been if someone chest passed it to you and you just walked away in disgust mid-game. Like, I'm not dealing with that. Pass it to me now. Now it's on the floor. But seriously, none of the peck stuff.
Dave, on a Sunday morning, are there any sort of passages of play that just make you think, this whole thing is absurd? Why do we do this?
Well, yeah, the whole thing, really. I completely agree with you. Like, I've often sat there just watching football or whatever, let alone playing it. You just think, this is mental. Like, just the one really for me is heading the ball from a goalkeeper's kick or kick out the hands. And you obviously do it. You have to get your head on it. Don't let it bounce, all that stuff. But then when you think about it afterwards, you think an object is coming out of the sky at a rate of velocity and my job is to stand underneath it and let it hit me on the head.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. I'm glad we're all coming round to this idea. I mean, as Pratt suggested, it is a very serious issue, but I think there is a more fundamental thing here. It's weird. Why do we do it? So, yeah, I think, yeah, maybe we could just get rid of headers.
Well, I mean, it appears possibly that could be the way it's going to go.
Okay, so so we've sold football, we've deconstructed it and realised how ridiculous it all is, and that really having a long career in football is actually a complete waste of time. So moving on, tell us about your third love of football. This is very curious one.
It's curious, and again, I've got a very specific player in mind that did it, Ben Olsen, who came on loan, I think, from DC United to Forest around the turn of the millennium. And it's something I've done myself, and I see it a lot of times. It's slightly different now because these holdings are now ginormous and all very electronically based. But back in the day when you could shift them around, the ball bouncing out over the holdings into the first row or onto the track at the City Ground where you could leap it, maintain momentum, get back over, take the throw. It always gave the crowd that buzz. If you were chasing the game, if you were on the attack, it was something that always... I've never seen it met with derision or frustration or disgust from the homes. It's always, yeah, you know what I mean? It really gives everyone a big lift.
It should be. It's a bookable offence, Dave.
Well, I mean, if it also flouts the laws at the same time, I'm extremely happy about that. I mean, obviously, jumping the hoardings a la Eric Cantona is a slightly different thing.
I would say
yeah,
so.
And that's a different connotation altogether. But I always, it was just a glorious thing. I can picture Ben Olsen doing it now, jumping over, his hair wafting in the breeze, jumping back over, possibly taking a foul throwing because he's American.
Yeah.
and it just been something that propelled the team on, something that always kept the team going and just something that's very boring and maintained momentum, but otherwise was a glorious thing to see.
My issue, perhaps, with this, I mean, whilst I quite like the urgency of mounting an advertising hoarding to go and do this thing yourself, you're overriding the ball boy service, the dedicated service provided to you by ball boys.
Yes.
Don't deprive them of their job. This is their duty.
Yeah, I can say that, Adam. You're absolutely right. And again, throwing it back to talk about myself. When we were trainees at Forest, we were the ball boys on a Saturday afternoon. We were the...
Of course.
So I'm not saying that they... would treat us any differently, the professionals. I'm not saying they were nicer to lads that are coming off the street, but I mean, you were up and ready to go if the ball went even half a yard past the touchline. And it does negate possibly what they are there for. But I always just like that fact of taking the matters into that, like, almost like even better if they shove the ball boy out of the way, get the ball and keep going, almost like, dismissing you literally out of hand. Get out of the way. I've got things to get on with, mate. That's why I liked him better.
Funny you should say that, because of it would be remiss of us not to revisit perhaps the ultimate act of ball boy disrespect. This is Joe Hart in the 2014 World Cup versus Italy.
Hey! 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 Give me a fucking ball!
Wow.
Jesus Christ. Whilst bearing in mind the context of it, England presumably chasing the game, I'm sure they were, or chasing a goal.
Stop.
It's a World Cup. It's a big deal. I still find it astonishing.
I mean, is that the same game with the Pirlo Panenka? Possibly.
No, that was 2012.
Wasn't it? Yeah. Well, I was trying to work out why that extreme anger was there.
It was post Pirlo Panenka. Jesus. So that, you know, it was probably still living with him.
Still living what's the phrase? Living rent free in the head. I mean
Pirlo had just hit the bar with a free kick. Right. So he was being tormented by Pirlo by this point.
That, I mean, that's especially at a big tournament like that where they're really quite officious about ball boys or ball people, they're called ball kids. That's what they're called out there. Christ, let's get that correct.
No, that FIFA speak for a ball boy would be, let me think, sort of diminutive sphere servant or something like TM.
that would fit. And they'd have had a think tank paid millions and millions of pounds to come up with that now.
So, I mean,
that's astonishing. I understand being stuck into not a game of that magnitude, but I mean, it's probably never been that irate about anything in his life, has he?
And it's only a few seconds either. It's not like he's been waiting for ages. Yeah. The ball goes out on the other side of the pitch, and he turns around immediately, expecting it to be there right away. And he also absolutely leathers the hoarding in the manner of Tamuri Ketsbaya, but he doesn't flinch. But I bet it hurt.
Of course it does. Of course it does.
FIFA wouldn't like that. No. Don't kick the hoardings. Definitely don't do that. I'm just trying to work out what the scenario would have been. I mean, the ball obviously bounced into the middle of nowhere in a massive stadium, so that ball was out of commission clearly.
Yeah.
And I reckon the ball boy went to run after it. I went, oh shit, what am I going to do? This poor kid getting absolutely harangued.
Maybe there's a lead to be taken from tennis tournaments, just like ball kids there with just a bag of like loads of balls.
Carrying loads.
Ready to throw them back in because they give it the Joe Hart rule. Anything that takes longer than 2 seconds to get the ball back and you're well within your rights to give them an absolute volley of abuse.
Well, he'd have been kicked out of the tournament for that behaviour at Wimbledon, no doubt about it. But then, half an hour later, he was out of the tournament anyway. So
screaming at this little girl in the skirt, "Give me a fucking ball!"
So
in your pocket, it's fine.
All these kids from like Harrow, wherever they come from, mother, I got screamed at today. Yes, give me the fucking ball.
We asked our listeners for perhaps more subtle examples of ball boy related mischief. We all, of course, remember Eden Hazard belting the Swansea ball boy. That's well known. This one's rather less well documented. Jake Murray says, at Spurs Villa a few weeks ago, I'm sure I saw a ball boy throw one of Matty Cash's sideline towels in their attacking third over the advertising hoarding. Pretty funny as a Tottenham fan as they kept putting us under pressure with those throws, but also questionable. Yeah, I mean, ball boys shouldn't be doing extracurricular activity like this, Prutz. They shouldn't be affecting the game. Don't touch the towels.
That's as an away side. That's what was happening to Villa, was it? I think that's absolutely right. If you're at home with your own ball, they should do anything to piss off the opposition side. Come running for the ball, roll it to his mate down or to their mate down the touchline, and he possibly rolls it. So you've got like a pro in between these two kids getting tormented. Throw like pig in the middle, throw it over his head. Come and get it if you want to get the ball. But anything
it's
that gives you
violence.
Anything that yeah,
it's exciting. That's
the great thing that there's a very quick that's the seed of most things in football. You can't do it because it incites violence. No matter what it is, it will incite violence. That's why no one's allowed to do fucking anything at all that shows any character around a football pitch because it incites violence. But I would love that. Ball kids just in full home kits, just really pissing off the opposition with the way that they monitor the footballing situation.
Did he throw the towel onto the pitch?
No, I think he threw it away out of reach.
So I thought maybe he was like a boxing fan and he was trying to make a point.
Villa had done here, yeah. That would have been a little bit too evocative, perhaps. Do you know what, Prutz, you're going well, you're in good form here, so I'm going to allow you a bonus love of football, only because I really like this one. Tell us about it.
It's the argument that occurs between what normally would be very dear colleagues when the Saturday afternoon drama comes around, or Tuesday night, or Wednesday night, or Thursday night, whenever football gets played nowadays. It's the argument between two teammates, which I do draw a line if we've seen something recently where we've got a goalkeeper dusting up his own defender, which you kind of think, I mean, I understand possible frustration on a football pitch. But, and again, it's something that I remember specifically because I've been, funny enough, lads, I've been in a situation where I've fallen out with a teammate, two in fact. One of them was at Stoke City, and it wasn't where, I don't think it was a Tuesday, but it was certainly something that we were making hard work. I was at Forest, it was with Jim Brennan, former Canadian international. For some reason, I was playing on the left-hand side of midfield, which Jesus Christ. And he was behind me at left back, and we fell out about something to the point where the ball had bounced out of play. I've turned round to make my very well-worded point to Jimmy, and Jimmy was calling me everything under the sun, and we were backwards and forwards to the point where we were about 5 yards away, pointing like a couple in a supermarket arguing over something tedious, like you've got the wrong coffee or the wrong brand of beans. And to the point where this section of the crowd, which is as you come out the tunnel in the corner, was the big stand to your right hand side, the fans were going,
that's the only reaction,
which kills it completely. I'm like, you're fucking rubbish. And he's like, no, you shouldn't. You had a chance. You passed. And then backwards and forwards. And they're just like, almost with the comical handbags, like, look at
I suppose that does diffuse matters.
Oh, completely. Yeah. And I think we got a bollock in half time from Paul Hart. I think Paul's taken it, might have been, because obviously big bugger of a certain era where he would have probably knocked someone out, saying, well, if you're going to have an argument, you might as well have a dust-up at the same time. Yeah. Don't do what you did there. It looks pathetic. Which I thought was absolutely... And the other one that stands out was when I was at Southampton, we played at Villa Park with Anthony Niemi in goal. Again, another fellow that I've gotten with really, really well. And it was that very cliched outfield player looking round at a goalie. Something along the lines of, can't you just catch... So, and there's a picture where it's post shove, and my neck is kind of, and my head's back, not quite Wilder Fury, but far enough back to suggest that he's just basically gone sod off and just launched me with his club. And again, he probably had a good point, as Jimmy probably did. Shut up, get on with your game, stop pointing the finger.
When it comes to teammates' disagreements, I mean, misplaced passes are always the genesis of this, perhaps. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. I tell you another one as well, which is something that always wound managers and players alike, it was the throwing up of the arms as if to say, how am I playing with this shower of shit? Always was a red rag to a bull to me, because it probably reinforced the fact of what I was thinking myself with all the self-loathing going on and playing football, thinking, oh shit, he's seen through me, he knows I can't find him with a pass. But it was like the ultimate, like, we're a team here, we're meant to, all the kind of fundamentals of what team sport's about. But the misplaced pass was always one that was, and again, it goes back to the fans going with them being frustrated about the ball not going where it needs to be. But it's almost like, do I have to explain to you that I didn't mean to not pass it to you?
Yeah,
surely you must know. Yeah. It defeats the purpose, the object of us all being together. Like me not giving the ball to the same colour shirt knackers the whole concept of what team football is.
You're absolutely right that there is the universal body language of, who the hell am I playing with here? This is a lot of absolute rubbish. But this is one of those rare things in football, Dave, that is completely universal from top to bottom. And does this sort of thing happen at Ribblesdale Rovers on a Sunday? Because I'm thinking the most classic, the most guaranteed Sunday league disagreement would be striker against defender. Striker look sort of shouting back 40 yards going, what the hell are you lot doing? With a complete lack of appreciation of the job that they have to do.
Yeah, usually... fuck's sake, don't let it bounce!
That's brilliant. That's the cardinal sin of any defender, like anywhere near the 18-yard box. Don't let it bounce.
Again, it's one of those things. Do any other country really care about it bouncing? it does feel like a curiously British obsession about
so
bouncing.
So and second ball's another lovely shout, isn't it? Which is,
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you can build a very mediocre 15-year career on getting on the second ball, lads, I can tell you that.
But no, yeah, teammate disagreements, they tend to escalate from the initial incident all the way up to basically high-level observations on the general footballing ability of the two people in question. And it basically comes down to me, I'm better than you. And that's what it comes down to. And strikers versus defenders at Sunday League is often a very one-sided affair, I fear.
Oh, look at that! That is wonderful!
Brought to your ears by The Athletic. This is Football Clichés.
Welcome back to Football Clichés. This is Mesut Haaland-Dix. This is David Prutton, and he's about to tell us all about the things he hates about football. What's your first one?
Hates. Wow. My first one is about the kind of vernacular used when it comes to describing football. Having moved into being able to talk, well, I say being able to talk about, being afforded the opportunity to talk about it, which is a wonderful thing, in my opinion. That's obviously purely subjective if you're listening to this. The kind of well-used tropes with regards to sentences, there and thereabouts, there or thereabouts is one, it just means absolutely nothing. Seeing them given could apply to literally everything on the planet. Like, it's not, it's just an all-encompassing, vague, chucked-out statement, which, having had the pleasure of being in a position where you can't, you're a pundit, you're talking about stuff and you're commentating, and then
no one has ever said, you know what, you know what, Fletch, I've never seen that given before
in my whole life. I have never seen that given. That's never. Oh, he's given it. Oh, now I have seen it given. Yeah. And it's great, because we kind of really deep dive and really drill down into listening to football, don't we? Because we all love it, and we're very quick to pull people up on football cliches, aren't we? And very quick to point the finger and castigate people for not saying the right things at exactly the right time. So I understand how tough it is. I understand having worked with brilliant commentators and brilliant guests and people that can deliver that in the right possible way in the moment is a genuine gift, and it's something that we all love and appreciate and really thoroughly enjoy. But they're almost like filler words, aren't they? It's like if you were typing out a WhatsApp and it just says type in, you might as well just say, and it was about the decision that's made, it just says type in. Oh, it's been given. All right. And I've seen them being given now. So they're just nothing phrases that are chucked out just to fill portions of silence, which to me now, having worked in it for a little bit, I'm actually quite glad of the silence. Just stop talking. Just don't say it. Just stop. And then we'll move on again. And I just stare at them and then we move on again.
It's good that you care about this sort of thing, because, of course, you're a rare example of a player who's gone on to ultimately to presenting, which is, I think, is, you know, relatively rare. I mean, punditry seems to be the kind of the easier option. So at what point did you decide, I don't want to be the guy who's asked which manager is happier at halftime? I want to be the guy who asks
which manager
is going to be happier at halftime.
It looks marginally more authoritative.
Why was that the option for you?
I was asked by Sky when I was working early on with them, due to a different circumstances, which meant that there were games that needed to be presented. And was something that I'd seen at close quarters with some very, very talented people, and just thought it looks like a challenge. It looked like fun. It looked something that could be quite exhilarating. And it is all of those things, absolutely.
And it means that you'll get to watch West Brom on a Friday night for the rest of your life.
Exactly.
For free.
Exactly. And exactly. With my feet up, eating as much chocolate and drinking as much coffee as I possibly can. But I enjoy it, without getting too deep and meaningful about it. I enjoy conversations, as you can probably tell, Christ Almighty, but just sharing space with people that have got a similar passion for this.
But that's interesting to me, right? Because hearing you talk today, you come across to me as though you'd be a brilliant pundit, because you're clearly very, you know, you're eloquent, you're intelligent, you're very happy to talk, and yet you're doing the role where you talk less than the other people.
That's a very good point there. I don't know whether that's, is it kind of reverse egotism? I don't quite know what that is. That's but I love when you do commentary and when you have got the chance to be able to give, it's like, Christ, that's all we do all day, every day, is give our opinions and give of ourselves, or give out the perception of who we want to be and how we want to be taken. That's whether it's talking about football, whether it's talking to your kids or whoever, or your friends, your missus, whatever. That's, it's always putting forth what you are. And that, I mean, obviously we're talking about a game of football, which ultimately is meaningless, but it to be able to discuss it, I think is a really rare privilege. And it's but the thing is, as well, from my point of view, without sounding horrendously ambitious, is the kind of football that I would work with would always hit a ceiling with regards to giving my opinion on it. Absolutely. It's not like, for us, we've had a dropout for Super Sunday or the World Cup final. Can you come and give? Yeah, well, when I was at Scunny, I was in a very similar position here, when the ball boy wouldn't give me the ball back and somebody was shouting from the crowd and everybody just looking at you going, no, we don't quite think that fits, mate.
Don't rule yourself out. Don't rule yourself out of Super Sunday. It's going to happen. You've got time on your side.
Exactly.
But then
what I also like with that is, and coming across these big stellar people that you kind of meet in the shadows at Sky or on site, is everyone's got the same fundamental love for it. People describe it in different ways. People dissect it in different ways, but it will always boil down to the same thing, regardless of who's playing. It's who's having the better day collectively over the course of that 90 minutes that will win the game. Absolutely will be the case. Whereas you see these cup shocks, that's what happens, where you see bottom beating top, an off day with someone who's got 100 million quid's worth of talent going forward. It fundamentally relies on the human. And that is why I think it's
practically perfect.
To focus on some of these offensive phrases, not literally offensive,
I've got loads of those.
Offending phrases, let's say. I mean, these are the tools of your trade in some respects. Some of them are perfectly fine to use. None of them are too bad. I mean, here we are speaking to a man who used the word totemic on Sky Sports 1 as far back as 2014.
Wowzers.
So clearly you take your vocabulary very seriously. I remember being very impressed by it. Wow.
Did you see the look on my face where I went? Hopefully I've used that in the right...
It's lovely.
Really, again, without boring you, I loved English at school. I love daft things. When you say, I like music, that makes you sound like a total dick.
Yeah,
but,
it does.
But what would suck me in, because it's quite a general opinion about what sucks you into music. It's either the melody or the lyrics. And it's the kind of melody that draws you in, and it's the lyrics that really kind of hit it home, I think, with the perfect song. So I'd always make sure that you'd read the lyrics and see, and anyone that was wonderfully flexible with the way that they use their words has always appealed to me. And some of the best commentators, I think I texted you about this, Adam, and you've had him on, the likes of Peter Drury, John Champion, lads who are really, I could list loads, Dave Farrow, Gary Weaver, Daniel Mann, I mean, all the ones that we work with. That delivery. Ironic that I got the word delivery wrong there, was it?
That's like a misplaced pass. I feel like I could grab you by the throat.
Yeah.
Now.
to get it right, and those iconic moments. There is a Sky advert, and sorry for shoehorning this in, where it says it's only live once, which obviously, if you read it wrong, it's only live once, which is a really eggy Bond film. And it's absolutely right, and to get it done. Like Martin Tyler does at the right time, the Aguero moment, things like that. Like trying to explain it to someone that's come from a different planet to go, sorry, someone shouting over a lot of people terracing around in shorts. Yeah. That's genuinely moving. You go, sorry, no, it is. It absolutely is. And the right words at the right time is an absolute gift.
I'm fascinated by the line that you draw between what's acceptable and not acceptable in terms of football cliches. So we asked our listeners for phrases they'd like to ban from footballs. Here's a small selection. Simon Trainer said, I'd ban the post/crossbar got in the way, came to the keeper's rescue, as if it's some sort of animate object. I mean, does that frustrate you? I quite like it. I think it's quite evocative. This kind of this sense that something might be conspiring against the person who was trying to score the goal. I think it's okay.
That works, yeah. It's either done in one where the goalie is beaten all ends up by... you see, I mean, the agonising look over his shoulder as his fingertips are clawing towards the top corner and it hits the bar and bounces out. Or the one where he's stood stranded as it's come off the backside of some kind of hirsute defender that's in front of him and rolls agonisingly towards the bottom corner only to spin out. I think that is absolutely correct in those circumstances, I think.
Yeah, quite right. Yeah, adds a sort of layer of intrigue to it all. Dave Mosin writes and says, referring to loaning out players as farming out. Needs to be banned ASAP. Absolutely horrible phrase. I'm not massively emotionally struck by it, but it is weird. It is a weird thing that we all say farming out, but it's a very specific type of loan, isn't it, Dave? Right?
Farmed out on loan. I feel like you don't really hear that much anymore.
Who gets farmed out?
I haven't heard that for a while. Who gets farmed?
I feel like you have to be a good young player, but not like an elite one.
The Chelsea players who go on four loans...
That's farming.
You know, consecutively. You know, Papi Gilabogi has probably been farmed out on loan again this season, hasn't he, somewhere?
If you're going to Vitesse, like you're being farmed. I mean, oddly enough, Prutz, I looked at your career path. You moved clubs 9 times in your career, but I don't think you were ever farmed out. You were just too good as a kid.
Let me think. As a kid, I had the great fortune of lots of injuries, which made me get into the first team very quickly at Forest, which was good. I got farmed out towards the end. The very last place I was at was I was farmed out from Sheffield Wednesday to Coventry, which...
Is it farming out at the end, though? Is that more not being put out to pasture?
Yeah, that's pretty... Yeah,
very good.
That is perfect.
Very good.
That is absolutely perfect. I mean, from a farming analogy background, that's absolutely superb. And I think, it was absolutely put out to pasture. It was borderline sent to the slaughterhouse, I'll be really honest, because it was, as I was driving down, I got a phone call off my mate saying, oh, you have to Coventry then? I said, yeah, it's sent to Coventry. And then he said, did they still play at Northampton? And I went, oh, Christ, they do, don't they?
That's a great start to a loan, not knowing where the club
played. And then the first game that we played was a home game at Six Fields, and pulling up. Oh, decent crowd here. Forgetting that there was a cinema shopping complex. It was a Saturday afternoon and everybody was going there.
Watching Toy Story 4 or something like that.
I think it would have been the first or the second one, I think, by the time
All right, yeah, it's a long time ago. What am I talking about?
Star Wars.
Yeah. Finally, maybe this is a good test for whether you would use this in your presenting context. Dave Bushell says he really hates it when a presenter asks, was that a case of Team A playing well or Team B playing badly? And then when the pundit simply says, probably a bit of both, would you accept that? You'd want more.
Yeah, you would.
That, right?
And I'm sorry to say that I have used that on occasion. I've also, there's another one which is good save or bad miss, which is awful,
both,
isn't it?
Which is, can't be both.
Which is, and this is the great thing about coming on here. I will forever, and I swear, if you're remotely bothered about watching what we do, I will be very gladly pulled up for using that, because as you say, it's not even a question, is it? It's just a lot of words put together which fill 30 seconds.
I'm afraid to say you are a man employed to present football broadcasting. You are guaranteed to ask that question in the next 12 to 18 months at least a dozen times.
The sad thing is you two have to watch every single thing that I do now just to make sure that I don't. Yeah.
Okay.
I have to watch the championship. Yeah,
exactly.
For God's sake.
Do you have to explain to you what that is?
But no, I will. Right, next up, this is your second hatred of football. This is very much close to games gone territory. Mm. Quite like it. Tell us about it.
And the thing, the song that jumps out as soon as I think about this is a song that I've liked from a band that I like. It's Goal Music. Obviously, it's the back of the net. Song 2 comes blasting out, which obviously is from a Blur album in the 90s, which has got some very good songs in it. Again, it's a song that's been played that much at that specific time that's completely ripped the arse out of it now. So it's one that I wouldn't make a beeline for. But anything, and it dovetails into what we said at the very start about what you love about football, anything that dilutes that specific moment of joy and euphoria. I've never heard a goal go in with music to follow that I've thought, oh, Christ, that's really added to the atmosphere here. That's really interesting.
Mm. I mean, Dave, the idea of it is fairly clear. It's this kind of artificial attempt to generate atmosphere after a goal goes in, if you even needed it. But no one's really ever thought about what makes good goal music or indeed bad goal music. I mean, Song 2 kind of does lend itself. It's a very obvious kind of rhythm, and it suits a goal going in. But I mean, what sort of song would you want to hear if you absolutely had to after a goal goes in at Watford, for example?
Well, I don't know whether I'm making this up or not, but when researching this, when I saw this was one of the options, I was thinking back, have Watford ever had goal music? And I'm sure we did in the sort of early to mid-noughties. And I think it was Eat My Goal by Collapsed Lung. I think it was. But again, it was so, it just didn't land.
So it's
you know,
got
the
goal
crowd
in the title.
It's even worse, the fact it's got goal in the title.
The crowds were not great, so it wasn't, you know, no amount of music or ever could raise the atmosphere. But the central problem with goal music for me is that 9 times out of 10, it is completely unnecessary. It's attempting to solve a problem that doesn't need to be solved because the crowds sing. They sing. They have songs to sing when goals go in. You don't need this.
Let's try and examine this phenomenon chronologically. I was trying to work out, perhaps, what the kind of the original, what really sparked all of this. And I suspect it's probably this. So this is Middlesbrough, right? This would have been Middlesbrough. Did Bolton play it? What did Bolton play?
And the video as well. That brings back memories of watching VH1 a very, very long time ago. That is exactly right. That deeply anchored, embedded memory has now been blown to pieces by Perfecto All Stars being the soundtrack to that goal going in. That's exactly what it was.
I don't think anybody. If you told someone the song title, Dave, I think if they were of a football persuasion, they would now hear it in their head with a kind of muted crowd behind them and not the original. Yeah. That's how deeply embedded it is.
And you'd probably have a player you'd associate it with, because that's also, you know, that also kind of, yeah, uses, can be used as a chant, can't it? Yeah.
That's true.
I mean, it's such a specific thing, and Dave's absolutely right. It's solving a problem that isn't there. You've not had to explain to crowds for eons the fact that you come in and football makes you feel a certain thing. That feeling makes you make a certain noise. You've not had to explain. So when the ball goes in that thing, you can shout as loud as you want. Do whatever you want. It's great. And you're like, oh, I never knew that. Thanks for telling me that. But it soundtracks something that doesn't need anything other than the sheer human emotion. Yeah. But, I mean, the music around football, I always think is interesting. Anyway, when we did the playoff finals in the summer, they had, I can't remember which final it specifically was, but obviously it wasn't packed out. But one of them came out to "Can't Stop" by the Chili Peppers, which is a fucking great song. And I was like, with the flames going, I thought, that absolutely fits this moment right now. That's amazing how that is like, and you hear the drums going and it's all building up. When I was watching Brentford Chelsea at the weekend, and "I Just Called to Say I Love You" by Stevie Wonder came on as the referee blew the halftime whistle.
I noticed that. At first I thought, is this "Happy Birthday" by Stevie Wonder? And then I thought, oh no, I actually realised what song it is. And I thought, it's quaint, it's charming, but it just feels inappropriate in a footballing context. Is that fair to say?
Quaint and charming, like Brentford is, but you can't. I mean, obviously, when they play "Hey Jude" before the game, it's amazing. It's just one of those where you went, they're playing Stevie Wonder. And it did like a great, like a medley, like "My Cherie Amore" afterwards. Come on, lads, let's get going for the second. Obviously it got Mendy going, didn't it, for the second half? He was flying.
Certainly did. So, of course, you mentioned Blur Song 2. That's very much one of the staples of goal music. As is, of course, "Sandstorm" by Darude. Now, Dave, this has become a very, very kind of established bit of goal music, but it's also responsible for possibly the saddest. Recorded instance of post-goal music. This is Tottenham taking the lead against Reading in a pre-season friendly last year.
Gets it back from Eric Dyer, looking to bend that ball in for Son Heung-min. Took it beautifully. Morrison is back there, and it's headed. It's ended up in the back of the net. An own goal.
Oh my God.
An own goal in a pre-season friendly. Don't play Darude Sandstorm. Don't do it. Don't do it. What on earth? I mean, this was, of course, when there was no crowds. There was no fans were allowed in the stadium, so that was the reason that they were doing it. But perhaps this is massively inappropriate.
I mean, let's be honest, it's a terrible song anyway. I mean, regardless of what situation it would be played. And I couldn't think for one second where I would say, can you play that, please? Because when you said "Sandstorm," I thought, oh, a really light cast. Then that came on. Like, not that one. And it's an awful cover version.
I know you're a guitar man. I've read your review of AC/DC's Back in Black on The Guardian. Absolutely sensational. I really didn't know you had this many strings to your bow. But think back to your playing career. You scored the greatest goal of your career, whatever that was. What song would you want playing after as you wheel away in celebration? I'd have "Lightning Seeds" "Life of Riley," because then it would just automatically assume it was one of the best 10 goals.
It's those emotional anchors, isn't it? Like you say, that song is absolutely that. Listening to that, it's amazing. What would I like to be played?
You'd actually need to signal to the sound man. As you begin the your mazy run, start play it now.
Get the intro. Get the intro. Jesus Christ! I'm trying to think what it would be. You'd have to go along the lines of something that was really kind of pumped up, or it would be something very boringly predictable, like a rock song, or I don't know, rock and roll style would be pretty cool, wouldn't it? If you had the kind of the chorus of that kicking in, but it's such an odd. The thing is with that as well, without boring you too much about this, and it never, very rarely happened in my career, putting the round thing in the big kind of rectangular thing with the net on the back. It's transcendent, the moment, because you fucking vanish. You disappear somewhere else, and then you come back and you go, it's either 20 people and a dog going, "What are you doing, mate?" It means nothing to nobody, this, what you're doing. Or it's something that's gloriously shared by a lot of people. And it's amazing. It's when we, and to go off on a slight tangent, when you talk, as we have the ability to do, to talk to lads that are like wonderful goal scorers, or you watch Lyle Taylor take a penalty, you watch Ivan Toney take a penalty, you watch Ollie Watkin, I'm not just mentioning Brentford players and Nottingham Forest players. We had Glenn Murray in last night that we were chatting to. And trying to get into the specifics and the minutiae of how they do what they did, I find that absolutely fascinating, because if I had time to think about it in front of goal, I would go completely to pieces. I miss penalties in penalty shootouts in training because I'm absolutely bricking it that much. It's pathetic.
You'd be scrolling through your Spotify playlist.
Exactly.
For a
start. Lads, 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 get this greatest hits on. What's it? It's Cast. It's All Chains. It's a great album. You'll love them. You'll love them. But yeah, and that side of it has always fascinated me about being able to do that and the presumption that it's a straightforward thing when it's far from it.
Okay, well, it's good to know that you know, a practicing footballer is not on board with goal music. That's reassuring to know. Let's round things off with your final hatred of football. I quite like this one. I think we've been building up to this because you, and then there's been a thread of self-deprecation all the way through this. You know, I wasn't that good. I'm rubbish. What am
whoa,
I like?
Did
but come
I,
on.
Whoa, I didn't say I was rubbish. Jesus Christ, well, mate. There is a line. I'm going to crumble in a minute.
Sorry, Jim Brennan asked me to get that one in.
He said the point he was making at Stoke was track your runner, you lazy sod.
Exactly, yeah. You're not prepared to put the answer. Yes. Anyway, yes, let's hear your third and final hatred of football.
There is, I mean, because we love the Premier League and how elite it is. It's like Hollywood, isn't it, on a pitch, which is wonderful. But I think there's certain people that you come across when you're discussing football and chatting about it. And we've now, it's sprung forth from obviously possibly what we do at Sky, that when you break down football and to the nth degree, and everyone's a pundit, everyone's an expert, and it takes away the kind of nuances of what it takes to get from A to B, which is A, wanting to do it as a kid, to B, someone actively saying, we're going to pay you to do that as your job. And it becomes obviously vocational. It's wonderful. Presumption that football of a certain level is relatively straightforward to get into and would have been a career choice if I could be asked. I didn't want to do it. I remember chatting to, and this goes hand in hand with a truly awful professional period at Swindon when we were, as a team, crap. And 90% of the individuals were very poor as well. And we had no team spirit. We had several managers that couldn't save us from ourselves. Deservedly ended up getting relegated. And thankfully, they're in a position now where there is a lot of brightness and a lot of positivity about that place. But as any group of responsible footballers do after being relegated, went for our first night out in Swindon. I mean, that, how on earth would that not have pissed everyone off and caused a lot of trouble? But one of the conversations that I had in a bar was about a fella chatting to me about playing football and who'd have thunk it in the middle of Swindon after getting biffed. And then him relating his experience at, I can't remember the denomination of this particular town was, whether it was a town, city, United, but playing for a club in Benidorm, which was the basis of this conversation was our middle ground. And I mean, hopefully it comes across that I'll chat and shoot the breeze with anyone, but having that used as the stepping stone of, well, I know what it's like, you know what's like, well, yeah, I mean, things not going right in football. And I was, what do you mean? He went, well, I was over in Spain at Benidorm. I was like, what? What? Doing what? Drink it? No, playing football. I couldn't get my head around the fact that was what the middle ground was. Well, yeah, we're all in it together. No, we're not. We're absolutely, I'm not really trying to be a dick about this, but we're not. We're absolutely not. And then this conversation went, and then in the end was like, I'll leave you to it. And we just went off. But that sense of almost kind of, sometimes that the dismissive tone that's used about, say, footballers that have spent a career, and the thing that intrigues me, and the thing that when we spend time with lads that have got to mid to late 30s, and there is a, take away the Premier League for example, but there is a side of football that can become, that's when that, like I said, the vocation of it, the passion of it is tested, because there's good times, there's bad times, and it is all relative. I completely understand that when I'm discussing this part of playing football, but there are the leaner times when you've got to really stick in and make sure you realise why you love the game and what that love for the game affords you, your lifestyle, your being able to look after your family, your friends, etc. The boring things of being a family unit where people go to work and do different things. There is that working aspect of what being a footballer is about, and that element of making it sound relatively straightforward, of getting out the absolute bun fight of millions of kids wanting to do the same thing and being able to then become a professional footballer. I've always fought footballers' corners for that, not because it's a badge of honour, but it's like, it's really fucking hard. Yeah, regardless of where you played, it's really hard to do what you were doing there to then go and do it over there.
I was going
to
say, Michael Cox wrote a piece on The Athletic in a few months ago in the summer, pretty much about that very point. He was saying that, I think if you look at the numbers in terms of the amount of kids that play football across the world, it is by far the most difficult sport to get to the professional level, even just getting, as you say, getting into sort of, you know, even semi-professional, you know, or non-league, or just in the lower reaches of the football league, let alone being a top player in the Premier League. It's incredibly difficult to do. But because it's the most played sport in the world, and that everyone feels like, I've played a bit at school, I've played a bit of Sunday League, oh, I had a trial, blah, blah, blah. I sort of know how it works and I've sort of done it. But actually, you don't know. You just don't. It's a million miles away from being able to do it successfully.
I feel like I can't mention my trial with Swindon Town anymore.
Adam, you'd have been better at Swindon than we were that season, mate.
We could have been teammates.
Do not worry about
stupid
that.
Stupid broken leg.
And me screaming at you for misplaced passes and not making my passes look good.
Okay, so yes, I'm completely on board. Yes, professional football, very hard to get to the top of. But what I'm more interested in is your palpable irritation at having to talk to a member of public about playing football. Don't deny it now, because that's exactly what happened. So, but this... Dave, this is why I want professional footballers on this podcast. I don't want to ask them what their pre-match meal was.
Boring.
I don't want to ask them whether they thought their international call-up was a prank. I want them to confirm what the precise feeling is when someone who doesn't know anything about football talks to them about playing football. And finally, we've had it. They actually find it really irritating and they hate it. It's fine. You can say you're approachable. You can say you like talking to the fans. Or if you move abroad, you can say it's great. You can walk down the street and no one recognises you. You can say all of that, but just admit it. You hate it when a lady
You get the sense of the eye roll, which almost knocks you over, as you can see. It was like, oh my god, here we go. This is what he thinks is the correct way to go about it. And it's funny because it's the kind of vast swathes of who I've spoken to and who you talk to in the interactions that you have. And it's not fans per se as a group. It's specific individual. Oh, it's crap. I mean, it's shy. You know, you're like. Well, I mean, I can see how you could say that in the sense of what's gone on just there. And I understand. I'm not digging in too deep to what you just said, but I mean, he's not crap, is he? He's not terrible, because he's managed to do. I mean, there are possibly people that stick out where you do kind of go, that is a total anomaly. How on earth is he getting paid to do this? Which I always find quite funny when that debate comes around. But it's there was a fantastic piece. This must have been when, I can't remember when this was, a few years ago. It was talking about Raheem Sterling moving from Liverpool to Manchester City, and obviously the uproar from a fan's point of view of can't believe he's done that. And you could see this, the article was totally understanding what the fans were saying, but it was trying to put forth devil's advocate of why Raheem Sterling might not feel the same way. And it was basically saying, well, do you know how many times Raheem's probably seen the conversation where teammates gone, the parents are coming in and so, oh, thanks, but no thanks. And thanks, but no thanks. And here's a contract, but you're not getting a contract. And that as his career path went, and obviously him going to the absolute very top of people dropping by the wayside. And it's slightly changing, I think. I've heard different things about it in the last decade or so, where there's that approach where we understand how earth-shattering this news could be. Relatively, of course, this kid who wants to be a footballer from the age of 8 gets to 16 and say, thanks, but can you sod off now, because you're not going to be any use to us, which is fundamentally what it kind of boils down to. He would have seen that, so therefore he was plotting his career. It's like him talking now about not getting game time. I might go somewhere else. You can't say that. Well, yes, I can, because it's my job and it's my career. So if I'm not playing here, I'm going to bugger off to somewhere else. And that might happen. This is me paraphrasing Raheem Sterling. But that's what players like that have got to fight through to get to where they've got to get. And it takes character, it takes grit, it takes determination. I understand that it's not remotely curing any of the world's ills, but it's relative to their experience in the professional world. And it takes a hell of a lot of grit and determination to get there.
What do you think is the... if you can think of one, what's like the most misunderstood thing about being a footballer?
But I mean, there is that other one, and I think it's coming out of perception now, where footballers are thick. You know what I mean? After running around for an hour and a half, I can't believe he didn't give me something really funny, witty and insightful.
No, that's
and he's
fair
still
enough,
sweating yeah. his balls off. Come on, tell us what you or explain that goal to me. Well, the reason he can't explain that goal to you is because there might not be a strand of the way that his brain works that eloquently puts that forward. There is a strand of his brain that works in a way that we can only dream of, because instinctively he was able to do that in the moment. So, I very much hesitate to use the word genius, but it's the instinctive ability to process problems at very high speed and for your brain to put out answer after answer after answer. That's what the very best players do. That is what the absolute very best players do. Some can explain it, say like Frank Lampard. Some, and this is me not using these as polar opposites, but like a Wayne Rooney, who's got a lot better from a media point of view. But the things that he could do on the pitch, the instinct that he was born with, that was bred on the streets of Liverpool, can't be explained, because that's something utterly primal to him, and that's how he expresses himself. Some are more eloquent, some are less eloquent, some are very good instinctively, some are better tactically, technically. That's what I love about it. And again, sorry to hijack this podcast just for me to talk about why I love football. But that's the most amazing thing. Watching people do things that you can't do, but not necessarily being able to explain them either, I think is one of the most wonderful things. This only comes to my mind because I was reading articles about it at the weekend. Paul McCartney trying to explain song lyrics, dreaming about yesterday, asking John Lennon, have you heard this song? Asking George Martin, have you heard this song? No, no. Oh shit, I've dreamt this song, and it will then go on to become one of the most covered and recorded songs of all time. That came out of absolutely nowhere. Wayne Rooney's overhead kick against Manchester City. That's gone over me.
Your tackle on Robert Pirès.
No, that was premeditated. I really disliked him. Really disliked him. I actually saw him in Euro 2016 in one of the media compounds.
Oh, God.
And someone said to me, go and say something to me. I said, do you honestly think, A, he remembers, and B, he remotely gives a shit about me going, Robert, the reason you might have a slight scar on the inside of your ankle is because I hacked you down 11 years ago around this time. I thought, Nally.
Suddenly, it turns out he's got idiot prattling on his phone.
Yeah. Saying, oh, he was rocking.
Oh, that was me.
He was rocking in the corner of the compound when he saw me. Like some Vietnam veteran. Alone. Jesus leave Christ.
Well, anyway, a spirited defence of the footballing profession there from future PFA chairman David Pratton. Jesus Christ, aren't you happy? What career are you happy
exactly.
with? Jesus Christ.
So greedy. So unbelievable. I'll be a great trade unionist when I Christ almighty.
You certainly would. So let's recap. We've talked about playing in front of the noise and energy of big crowds. We've lamented the death of the diving header, rarely seen nowadays. You've expressed a very curious liking for players jumping over the advertising hoardings to get the ball back, despite there being ball boys around to do it for them. You've enjoyed teammates arguing on the pitch, which I think we can all agree with. You've expressed some massive distaste for the phrase there or thereabouts. So I'd like to see you use that.
That's
very
definitely getting
on
used.
Sports, please. Thank you. Goal music, very much the universal dislike of pretty much everybody. That's fair enough. And then finally, a very, very, very spirited speech about how annoying it is when people try to talk to you about being a footballer when they haven't got a clue. Glad you came on this podcast then. David Pratton, you've been absolutely wonderful. Thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, chaps. Like I said, without blowing smoke up your ass, it's better to do that at the start than people are nice to you, aren't they? I listen to it a lot. I think it's very, very good. Like I said, I love the intricacies and the minutiae of how we use vocabulary, and I love the fact that there's a whole kind of feel to be picked up on stuff like this. And I'm so acutely aware of it now that, I mean, people might say I'm robotic at the best of times, but oh my God, I'm going to be sat there writing and rewriting every single little thing that is possibly...
Clichés are not a crime, David Pratton.
Well, and that's the thing, isn't it? The clichés are seen as something that we should veer away from, but the reason clichés and stereotypes exist is because they're so unbelievably prevalent, aren't they?
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Well, in that case, you're very welcome. cheers to you, Dave.
Thank you.
Cheers to you, Prats.
Cheers, fellas.
And have a lovely weekend, everybody else. See ya.
The Athletic.